free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
We're joined this evening, September 7, 2009, by James C. Torgerson, MD, PhD, and DSC. He's involved with me in the Safe Haven Village project, in which we are developing an intentional community based on principles of sustainability, educational outreach, healthy living, healthy natural healing, individual responsibility, cooperation, and renewable energy. Torg, that's the name he prefers, is like the professor of our Gilligan's Island. He's a great example of someone who has been implementing what he knows. He especially likes to sample inexpensive ways to do things like sun ovens made of tinfoil, duct tape, and cardboard, or compost toilets comprised of a 5-gallon bucket and sawdust. Tonight, we'll be talking about sustainable, intentional communities in general, building types such as Earthship, Cobb Ship, shipping container homes, compost toilet, gray water recycling, rainwater harvesting, renewable energy greenhouses, community documented. Rather than stumbling, Torg, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Great to be here. What a bumper night, huh?
This big, long introduction for you. You know, Torg is a good old friend of mine. I really enjoyed getting to know him. You know, one of the reasons I got involved in this intentional communities is because I trusted that you knew what you're doing. It's nothing like being involved in a bomb shelter with somebody who knows what he's doing, and Torg's that kind of guy.
It would be nice to think so. There's always the unexpected. That's one thing you can always expect is the unexpected.
Yeah, it's nice to be ready for that. How did you get involved in all this stuff?
In all this stuff? Kind of mutates gradually. Comes most of my predilection for being an urban shaman and wanting to know how to stay in touch with Mother Earth. And then taking a real close, careful look at the rest of my life and saying, what is the stuff that does not make sense? What is not sustainable? What's not long-term? What kinds of things here would my great-grandchildren's great-grandchildren say, what were you thinking when you tried that, you know? And I've kind of thought that way my whole life. I really honestly think that I've always been more or less like that. My dad was an environmental engineer, designed sewage and water treatment plants, so I grew up knowing that we were impacting the things around us and having to deal with the effluence of affluence. That was kind of my lifestyle. So I would have to say I'd have to go back about 40 years, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And being an engineer, of course, you know, I grew up understanding how buildings were built, how communities are put together, how things interrelate, at least on the physical scale. He wasn't much of a sociologist, but he could figure out where the traffic flow would go and how to figure out a way around it.
So what is, in your opinion, what is sustainability?
Sustainability, in word, is that within the range of human comprehension, at least so many generations away, that whatever you're doing will maintain itself within your local environment. So in other words, a sustainable home doesn't need to have anything from the outside world. What on our terms would be forever. We like to use the 7-generation model of the Iroquois Confederation. You know, my great-grandchildren's great-grandchildren are still in the same house and still have not had to ask the outside world for anything, then it's sustainable. Now, of course, ultimately, entropy rolls everything down. The earth's going to fall away and the sky will fall someday and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I can't plan for the infinite future, only the foreseeable future. And that's my model of sustainability. So, you know, I prefer to start off with that model. A lot of people think sustainable means I can build all the glass and steel and concrete I want as long as soon as it's built, it maintains itself. And I'd rather start a step back from that and say, let's just walk into there with me and whatever I can carry and go on from that point on. So if I can go on the side with a shovel and a hoe and maybe a hammer, you know, so sleeping bag and stuff like that, and walk out a year later with a really nice house and all the rest of stuff, that would be my ultimate goal. We can't quite do that, of course, reasonably. None of us like the Robinson Crusoe lifestyle, but, you know, within reason, that's a sensible way to go.
But for me, this isn't just a matter of curiosity. It's a matter of maybe even survival, as I plan to move with my family to a house along these lines. And, you know, this is something that we're going to be doing here in the next months here.
Right. It is for me, too. I don't see any reason to locate someplace where, you know, somebody else pulls the strings on my lifestyle. I don't want to be worrying every day in the hot summer with a good brownout. I don't want to worry whether some earthquake is going to show up my water supply. I don't want to be concerned about what other people are doing. I want to interact with the world at large. I'm not a hermit, but I want to interact on my terms.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what is this seventh generation principle. You've touched on it, and
right.
You've done a great job on that.
The seventh generation principle is really simple. It says that we're responsible for what we do, not just to ourselves, not just to our listeners, and not just to someone in sight right now, but to someone way down the generational line. Seventh generation means that seven generations from now, I want them to look back and be proud of the fact that I was their ancestor. And I can't honestly say that about most of my ancestors. You know, some of them were, you know, Scottish robber barons that just didn't treat their people nice. And others were Mormon pioneers that came in here with one goal in mind, and that was to reap as much as they could possibly from the land and not pay attention to consequences. As a result, a whole lot of stuff got destroyed and a lot of things got washed away, and, you know, that ethic just doesn't fit anymore. It didn't fit then, but they didn't know that. So I'm going to do the best I can with what I do know. And someone was saying the other day, well, you know, how can you do that? How can you say for certain what our seventh generation great-grandchildren are going to say about something? And I don't know. You know, maybe they'll be living in some kind of a Star Trek future of all glass and steel and have excess energy that can do all that they want with and all that kind of, I don't know. All I can do is say, here I am, I'm a shaman, this is Mother Earth, this is what I think she wants, and I want to make sure I can maintain my place on the earth in comfort for the rest of the time and eternity here. And that's the best I can do. That's all I can offer anybody. And that's all I wanted from my ancestors. That's all the generations had to offer from me. But the Iroquois Confederation, that's what their mode of ethic and conduct was. Everything we do is going to be looked at by our children, our children's children, our great children, stuff like that, and all the way down the line. And they were right. They have and they do. And that was the Confederation that came up with the model for our own Constitution. So we're still looking back at them after all these years and say, good job, guys. Thanks for burying the hatchet and showing what can be done.
So now we live in a time when things are kind of in meltdown mode in a certain extent. Where do we go from here?
The same place anybody else ever goes. It doesn't matter if things are in meltdown mode or if they're not. You still have to look at everything you do on a day-to-day basis and say, does this make sense? I like to think of the alien model. If I were to surf in a spaceship, I just showed up here, would watching what we do make sense? A huge amount of it just doesn't. You know, we bustle around and do all kinds of stuff. On the surface, looks like we're creating an incredible amount of industry and everything else. But when it boils right down to it, after a few minutes or years or whatever, makes no sense at all. It doesn't do any good. Why are we living in houses with two people in 12 rooms? Why are we making freeways to places where we don't need to go? Why are we driving to and from work 40 hours a week when we could sustain a lifestyle that would be much nicer on 10 hours a week and stay home? Why do we do these things? We don't step back and ask the right questions. There's an exercise we have to go through at the foundation, the Open Mind Foundation, where I'm the president, where we do that during our staff meetings. Say, okay, we think we got the answer now. Let's assume that we really don't, and keep stepping back from the question until we're sure we've asked the right question. As an example, we developed a process for making building blocks out of garbage. And it's a good process. We like it. It's powerful. It's strong. It makes garbage go away. It does nice building and stuff. And after we sat down one time and said, okay, we've got a business plan on the rest of this stuff, let's step back. And we stepped back a little bit and said, okay, these houses we're designing, do they make sense? And one of the architects came up and said, you know what? We don't need to have separate great rooms and rec rooms and all this stuff. You can do those all in one place. Cool. So we cut the size of the house down a whole bunch. Somebody else stepped forward after that and said, why are we building, assuming people are going to travel to and from work every day? We've got computers right here. And most of the people that are traveling back and forth are going to places where they've got a computer. So why don't we up the size of that and assume they're going to be staying home and cut the size of the garage in half? Okay, so maybe that design changed. Now we're getting a little bit close to the real answers. And when the day is finally over, or the month or the year or whatever, we looked at stuff and said, you know, almost everything we get comes in big, tight bales of plastic and fiber and cardboard and stuff like that. And we're tearing things apart, putting them through a machine, melting them down, forcing them out, making block, and then making something out of them. Why don't we scrap the entire manufacturing process and just stack those bales? And none of us could think of any good reason not to, except maybe property size, because the walls you end up with that way are really thick. But we can end up, we can build a house for a tiny fraction of what a regular house is built for if we have space in our property by just stacking the bales of the garbage that we were sent, theoretically, to remanufacture. Since that's what we really want to do, is remanufacture directly into homes if at all possible. And that's what our business plan revolves around now. And it ends up costing about a tenth of what a normal home does, and it's almost so efficient that it starts off-grid. You don't even need to add energy for heating and cooling and stuff. But that was a result of the step-back process, not assuming we knew what the answer was before we actually got there.
When we talk about an Earthship, for those who've never heard of an Earthship, let's talk about what that is.
Okay, I'm a Trekker from a long time ago. I'll admit it openly. I've written Star Trek books and stuff. And there's an old ethic that says something on the order of a difference that makes no difference is no difference. Or man is a rationalizing creature, not a rational creature. Well, there are two kinds of structures that human beings have known how to build for a long time and have inherent qualities that we should make use of. And one is the greenhouse. Now, we've been building greenhouses almost since before we knew how to make glass. People have closed off areas and used oiled, probably rawhide and amendment and stuff to make an inside environment that was somewhat insulated from the outside and had extra heat and light. They did this in Europe all the time. All the aristocrats had greenhouses as part of the places that they lived in, but they did not live in the greenhouses. That was for the plants. Another phase would be to step up to the people in Northern Europe that made sod houses. They would dig a hole in the ground. They'd take the sod they dug out of the hole. They'd build walls and put a roof over it and bury the whole thing. The modern version of that might be a hobbit house. But back then, you know, it was a place that only the poor people could live. And when the Mormon pioneers came across the plains from Missouri and stuff out here to Utah, where we are now, they built the same kind of sod houses, but they always felt embarrassed by them. These are piles of sod. You know, it's a pile of dirt, basically. You can crawl into it, and you'd live nice and all that kind of stuff, but all the rich people were building stick and skin, 2x4s, skin on the outside, expensive to run, but they were rich. They could afford this. They made nice houses above the ground. They were flimsy and blew away in every tornado. So you got these two concepts. You got a hole in the ground that stays stable because it's in the ground. And most of these sod houses are still being used today. Okay, they're being used as bomb shelters or as tornado shelters and as root cellars because they're stable. Well, you fast forward to a guy named Mike Reynolds, and he says, let's take this, put them together. Let's dig a hole in the ground, put a glass front on the front of it, and make a greenhouse on the front of this hole in the ground. We're going to call that an Earthship. They're very stable. They're very light. They're wonderful. And that's what an Earthship basically is. He built his out of round-drift tires, which made good use of the fact that tires are really hard to destroy, and the round earth is very stable inherently, and put them together in a single system.
There's also this, what would you say, the firm principle or the thermal mass?
Thermal flywheel, yeah. Thermal flywheel is actually the exact opposite of insulation. Thermal flywheel says that how much energy you put into something, it spreads throughout the whole mass immediately, it just stays there. But it also comes out immediately, no matter what happens. So if you can put something in a house or in a structure, it's a high thermal flywheel that stores huge amounts of energy and distributes that back out again.
And we're going to be going to break here. But when we come back, let's talk about one of the most controversial things of these buildings, a compost toilet.
Visit us online at 1100kfnx.com. I promise. plugged the scan gauge 2 into my car in 10 seconds and could read my gas mileage instantly. It helped me save on fuel by improving my driving habits. If my check engine light turns on, I can figure out why without paying a mechanic. This device has saved me money.
The scan gauge also provides information about engine load, ignition timing, and on my vehicle, it tells me the transmission temperature.
The scan gauge is manufactured right here in Mesa. Call us at 480-656-3842 or visit us online at scangauge.com. Again, that's 480-656-3842.
I'm living paycheck to paycheck. We're so far into debt.
All we do is fight about it.
We don't know what to do anymore.
How would you like to get a call finding out that your Visa bill had been reduced from $8,000 to $4,800? What about discovering you had an extra $500 to $1,200 in your budget per month because of what you are saving on your credit card bills? All of these dreams are possible when you make 1 5-minute call to Jordan McKenna. They will match you to a reputable law firm that can stop harassing collection calls, reduce your monthly payments, and save you literally thousands of dollars off your credit card debt. They work for you, not the credit card company, so you can get the maximum savings possible for your situation. Call for free information now. 800-308-9952. Individual results will vary, so please review all program details and terms. Call 800-308-9952. That's 800-308-9952. 800-308-9952.
Are you struggling with your child, teen, or codependent adult?
Is he or she disrespectful, unmotivated, and defiant? Don't you wish they came with an instruction manual?
Well, there is hope. The Parenting Workshop is a 15-hour audio training based on Christian family values.
The Parenting Workshop will help you regain influence and control of your loved one.
Don't give in or give up. Learn how to fight for them, not with them. Visit ParentingWorkshop.org today.
25 years of success.
ParentingWorkshop.org.
Free energy now.
Kelly Allen coming back at you. I'm talking tonight with James D. Torgerson. We call him Torg. We're talking about Safe Haven Villages, a community working on together. He and I are involved in this project. We're talking about sustainability, intentional communities, building types, earthship, cowship, shipping container homes, compost toilets is what we'll be talking about next. What are compost toilets? It sounds like a weird thing to do with that unspeakable thing that we do every day, many times a day. We like to just flush it away. What's a compost toilet? That seems really weird.
Well, it seems weird to a lot of us in the Western world. We've grown up with this weird ethic that I'm not quite sure where it came from, of hiding ourselves from whatever happens. You know, we sit in our nice little boxes, and this magical stuff, electricity, comes in from who knows where. Magical stuff, water, comes in from who knows where. And if you have feces and stuff like that, you put it in this to bright white porcelain, you take some of that nice clean water, and you flush it away to who knows where. You know, and it's because we're living as isolationists that this seems strange. I didn't grow up that way. I used to help my dad build his sewage treatment plants, you know, when I was maybe 11 years old or so. And I always viewed sewage as something that actually created resource in the long run. I watched the stuff come into the plants, be processed, turn into activated sludge or whatever, and go back out on farmers' fields. And even then, as an 11-year-old, as a Cub Scout, I looked at it and say, why do we go through all this? Miles and miles of underground pipes and take all this water that we cleaned up the canyons and used to wash this stuff down and everything else, when you could just do that in your house, probably. And, you know, even if you have a septic tank, those are things that most people wouldn't choose to have if they could choose not to. So if you take that and make some sense out of it, you create what's called a composting toilet. After all, feces and urine and stuff like that are things that someplace out in nature, eventually it's going to be eaten by some of the bacteria, provide nutrition for some plants someplace and stuff, and why should I take the effort and spend tax dollars to feed somebody else's crops? So basically, a composting toilet is advised to take feces and stuff with very minimal, if any, water at all, and process it into a usable plant food right there on site, right there under your backside, actually. And you can design them any way you want. There are commercial versions that might cost in the thousands of dollars that look fairly conventional, like a white porcelain piece of stuff. I prefer personally to, you know, design to match my own, you know, cabinetry in my house. And if I have, you know, granite countertops in the kitchen, I'll put a granite countertop there and sit on it instead. But they're sanitary, they're healthy, they don't smell bad. People look at them and they're not quite sure what they are, but they try to figure out if some reason not to have them. And once you've actually worked with one, I've never heard anybody say this is a bad idea. I'm going back to flushing my toilet with clean water and paying taxes for it. Now, there are health requirements that say, well, we know where it came from, so probably there's a health risk, even though no one's ever actually shown a health risk to this stuff. So let's say you just can't use it on low-level garden crops. You can't use it on carrots. You can't use it on lettuce. But you can use it, if you're careful, around things that raise up out of the ground, you know, like fruit trees and even tomatoes and things. It's called humanure, and you can look it up on the Internet and get a whole manual and say, oh, well, why didn't I think of that? Well, actually, it hasn't thought of. Most of the world looks at us and says, why are you flushing this stuff? What's wrong with you guys? And we look at them and say, how can you deal with this crap? You know, literally. And the point is, it's not hard to deal with. It's actually easy to deal with. I lived for a whole year and a half during my formative days as in the office guarding a warehouse where we were building some of our products and stuff like that. And we had a human toilet, a real primitive one. It was just the bucket itself, actually, with a lid on it and a toilet seat. And whenever I got about half full, I'd, you know, cycle it around, take it out back, and I had this row of flowers growing on the back fence. They were the biggest, prettiest, happiest flowers in the whole neighborhood. As the soil was growing, I was basically marginal, and I was demarginalizing this 4x50-foot strip of stuff. I wasn't even composting it. I was just dumping, digging, and planting.
Yeah, to put it simply, if I understand right, like the toilets by SunMar, that's sun-mar.com, I may have them on an interview just to talk about that product and the entire show. It's fascinating stuff. Basically, just put some peat moss in with the droppings, and turn a little crank, and after 2-3 weeks, you take just a very small amount of, it looks like dirt, out of a tray at the bottom of the toilet, and you use it for, as you would the peat moss.
Exactly. I've done several YouTube things on simple household devices through our website, the Empowerment Channel, and that one thing, for some reason, has fascinated people. I've got more hits on that than every other thing put together. People look at that and say, wow, I never wondered about what happened. You know, after I flushed the toilet. I know I'm paying taxes to bring clean water into my house, and it's frustrating to watch these gallons go away every time, but it never occurred to me we didn't have to do it this way. We grew up.
Well, you know, the SunMar products, you actually can replace your existing toilet in a conventional home. With one of these units, it'll fit where your toilet fits, except rather than flushing it down, you just take in some dirt out every once in a while and putting it in on your lawn or, you know, your flower bed or whatever.
Exactly. And you can do the same thing with a real cheap when you build out of a 5-gallon bucket. You just have to be a little more creative. It doesn't come from the factory all completed. But, you know, being a handyman remodeler, and that's why I paid my way through medical school, that doesn't bother me. That just means I can personalize it. You know, the downstairs bathroom in the house I'm living in right now, we're making the whole thing look like something from an underwater version of Atlantis with ruins and stuff. So this is going to be a Grecian pillow you sit next to on a marble slab, and that's it.
Gray water.
I prefer to have a fan going, but you know. What's that?
Let's talk about gray water.
Okay. Gray water is water that's neither clean nor dirty. It's water that comes out of your shower, that comes off your roof, that does not come out of your toilet, which is classified as black water. And a lot of people worldwide drink their gray water. They have no problem with that at all. Personally, here in the United States, we like things a little bit clearer. We like to be able to see through our cup and, you know, not be able to see, you know, little floaties and stuff in there. But gray water is so easy to handle, it's incredible. You can go out and buy a gray water filter and pay $1,000 for it. And we get, end up with a tube about 8 inches across, about 5 feet long, with a hole in the top and a hole in the bottom you plumb in with. But if you take that thing apart, just slice it down the middle, it's full of sand. It's basically a plastic tube full of sand, sometimes with a charcoal filter stuck in the bottom. And that's it. That's the whole thing. That's a gray water filter. And it's kind of silly when you think about it that that's all that we do to clean our water in our houses. Now, I live... Yeah.
Go ahead.
Now, in Salt Lake City, where I live, we have water treatment plants. And everybody looks at it and says, wow, we have well-treated water in Salt Lake City, which is true. We give it all the treatment it needs, and then we do some other treatment to it that we don't need, things like chlorine and stuff like that. But all they are, when it comes right down to it, is a big swimming pool thing shaped full of sand. and the water comes out of the creek, runs across the top of the sand, down through it, and out the other end where they add some chlorine and store it. And that's it. That's the big fancy, you know, white shell and a shell. And a lot of people get disgusted. They go up there on school tours and stuff and say, this is all you do to our water? Yeah, that's all we do. Water's usually fairly clean. And in Salt Lake, we're lucky by having nobody upstream. So we don't have industrial concerns up there jumping garbage in our water. Most places in the United States don't anymore. You know, by far and large, the greatest number of things going into our rivers nowadays are quite clean. So we just don't need as much treatment as we think we do, actually.
So we just treat our gray water. In one of these sustainable homes, what's happening to the gray water? What are you doing with it?
Well, basically all you need is a cistern. You know, a 55-gallon drum for the average two-bedroom home is way more than enough water for all your regular use and stuff. And you may want to put another one up on the roof in a greenhouse hot box to keep some hot water up there. But simplistically, you just look at it and say, how can I keep all this stuff within the building? It's not that hard. You just drain it into a sand, fill it down to your cistern, and pump it back up again.
And use it how?
Any way you want.
You shower?
Sure, shower, drink, water your plants.
Okay. Well, when we come back, let's talk about harvesting rainwater.
Live streaming audio on demand, 24 hours a day. Log on now at 1100KFNX.com.
KFNX.com.
CNN Radio, I'm Greg Black. Tens of thousands of San Francisco commuters busy tonight plotting a new route to work in the morning. Caltrain director Randy Iwasaki says they won't be able to use the Bay Bridge because of ongoing efforts to fix a crack.
Our goal is to get that completed by 5 a.m. on Wednesday morning for Wednesday morning's commute.
Look for President Obama to come out swinging when he appears before Congress Wednesday night to talk about health care reform. Aides say Obama's adopting a more aggressive stance on the need for a reform bill. If you're still trying to make up your mind about the president's school speech tomorrow, you can read the text of it on the White House website. Some parents have said that they don't want their children hearing a speech from the president while they're in class. Well, she's only 17, but she's taking the U.S. Open by storm. American Melanie Udan advancing to the women's quarterfinals with an upset earlier today of Nadia Petrova. This is CNN Radio.
Hi, everybody. Jim Howell from KFNX Weather Center wrapping up a Labor Day. It looks like pretty standard monsoon forecast the next couple of days. Most of the storms in the high country, maybe some blowing gusts down here in the evening hours. Our daytime highs about 102 to 104. Jim Howell, KFNX News Talk Radio, 1100.
Currently, in downtown Phoenix, it's 94 degrees.
The Lars Larson Show, right on the left coast.
We're almost 8 months into the Obama administration. Are we safer by your estimate or less safe?
I'm more concerned recently in the past 7 or 8 months. I mean, there seems to be a little complacency as if people have lost what I consider to be a fundamental notion is that we're still in the crosshairs of these zealots, these extremists, and we better not think otherwise.
Catch the Lars Larson Show, weeknights at 11.
I plugged the ScanGauge 2 into my car in 10 seconds and could read my gas mileage instantly. It helped me save on fuel by improving my driving habits. If my check engine light turns on, I can figure out why without paying a mechanic. This device has saved me money.
The ScanGauge also provides information about engine load, ignition timing, and on my vehicle, it tells me the transmission temperature.
The ScanGauge is manufactured right here in Mesa. Call us at 480-656-3842 or visit us online at ScanGauge.com. Again, that's 480-656-3842.
Listen carefully. I have something very important to tell you.
Phoenix is so hot.
Sedona is not.
Cool off at the Sedona Summit Resort. 3 days and two nights for only $199. Call Crazy Coyote Activities and Tours at 877-444-8044. That's 877-444-8044. Hurry, offer expires soon.
Oh, hot, 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 hot. Oh, hot, 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 hot.
Terms and conditions apply.
We will work without a profit. Grab the focus and the words we say. We want to make the world a little bit better. We just want to help the world today.
Free energy.
now.
We really want to change the world today.
Eagle Mountain, Utah.
We'll always take the nation's death for sure. Or some hard work volunteering. Give a little and you get back more. You know the future's looking brighter. We just want to help the world today.
Free energy now.
That's the toll-free call-in number if you're listening live, 866-536-1100. We are broadcasting live out of KFNX in Phoenix, Arizona. And, Torg, you've got some people down there in the Phoenix area that may be listening to this live. Have them go over to the phone and call up if they want.
I'll do that. Bethany, Katie, how you guys? Give us a call.
Hey, speaking of making this personal, that little introduction in the show that we do each week where they talk about imagine a world where you could drive without ever stopping to fuel, that's Susan Carter that does that. She's also involved in this project. And it is her birthday today. Happy birthday, Susan, if you're listening.
Absolutely.
She's part of the Safe Haven Village. It's a very, very active park. Involved in helping us get the community documents together, getting the land. We actually have put our own house on the market so that we can buy that land, and then we'll be relying on some other people in the community to help us build a new place to live. So we're really going for the gusto on this thing. We said before the break that when we come back, we would be talking about the rainwater harvesting. How does that work in a sustainable scenario?
Well, basically you have to do that, unless you happen to be living on a stream, and you can rely on that stream. Streams, by the way, clean themselves very effectively, and it's every few feet or so, depending on type of stream. They're effectively cleaned of all kinds of pathogenic bacteria and stuff, because most pathogens are not anaerobes, or not aerobic bacteria, which means they're killed by oxygen. So the rainwater falling out of the sky will almost never have any pathogens of any kind in it at all. You're not going to find E. coli there. You're not going to find Giardia there. Any amoebas there. They just won't be there. So you can drink rainwater. You can drink snow when it comes out of the sky. Collecting it is not that big a deal. You build the kind of roof that the water hits, it flows off. Put it through a sand filter, take care of any kind of smog and pollution it may have picked up in the process. And then you're home free. It's distilled water. It's almost always cleaner than water you get out of your tap. It's just for some reason. What's that?
Would it make sense to have a valve so that the first 10 minutes of runoff you would maybe send somewhere else, as opposed to the stuff that after, the soot and whatnot has been covered for the most part?
I've seen systems designed like that, and especially in places like Phoenix, for example. We tend to have a lot of dust in the air. The first few bits of a regular monsoon storm, it makes sense to, get rid of that. And so the stuff that washes your roof off and everything. I know some people in the Phoenix and Tucson area, and Scottsdale and all down at Yuma, for example, that have built gray water systems for their houses, and they've all put some version of a plastic or a tin tile or some other kind of an impermeable roof on that washes off immediately. And just prior to the monsoon season, they'll go up and scrub the roof off to make it absolutely clean, no bird droppings and that kind of stuff. Doesn't take that much processing, but, they agree with that if you can make it so the first water that hits sets off a timer, and like you say, it waits for like 10 minutes. And if it's still flowing well at the end of that 10 minutes, to go ahead and start filling your cisterns at that point. And there's plenty of water that falls during an average monsoon year in your desert cities down there to handle a house the rest of the year. So you're not wasting it. You don't need it.
Did you put that into a cistern, and then you pump that up and use it for drinking water, use it for your sinks and toilet?
Well, you do everything you would normally do. Right.
You're not going to be using it for your toilet.
You don't put
any water in your toilet.
That's right. Your toilet uses no water at all. Your sink uses as much water as you want to because you're not wasting any. Goes straight down through your own sand filter, back to the basin, gets pumped right back up again. And
do you use toilet paper for toilet?
You can. There's actually a company called Seven Generation Products, and I like their stuff, where the toilet paper decomposes really fast. You know, very next time somebody
uses the toilet paper does as well, and the composting toilet, no problem, right?
It does. It's no problem. I just prefer to use things from people who have an ethic that I agree with. And, you know, if Kimberly Clark doesn't use a lot of recycled materials and somebody else that does and it costs a lot more, I don't really have any problem using Kimberly Clark stuff because it, you know, it works fine.
Regular treatment plants, you know. What about raising your own food in a sustainable situation so you're not even have to buy food?
It usually involves a lifestyle change more than anything else. If you think about it, all the farmers all through history that lived on the outskirts of places have been off-grid. They've all raised their own food. They've used acreage to do it with, though. And that's the big change we in the modern era have. We don't have acreage, usually. And we don't have the luxury of saying, okay, I'm going to sit in my house and, you know, farm the 30 back lot of my house and do this, that, and do the other, and everything, store stuff all winter long. But we do have the advantage of knowing a lot of things that my ancestors did not know. Now, when my friend's father heard that we were trying to build a sustainable community and grow our own food, he says, why would you want to do that? That's the way I grew up, and I hated it. Spent all my time from dawn to dusk planting things, pulling up weeds, processing this, that, and the other, and then at the end of the spring, he tried the whole thing all over again. He doesn't understand. If you change your lifestyle just a little bit, if you change a lot, actually, you can go to raw fruits and vegetables, then it's easy to do. But if you get away from things that take acreage to create, which are mostly your grains, then it's amazing how easy it gets. You know, a zucchini plant, everybody knows, you kind of plant it, stand back, and then beat it back once in a while with a whip and harvest something. And a lot of the other plants are that way as well. If you eat a lot of plants that grow really fast, convert a lot of biomass in a hurry, like salad greens and carrots and members of the hyacinth family, like potatoes and beans, or not beans, but potatoes and tomatoes and peppers and stuff like that. Once you get used to change in lifestyle, it gets away from breads, basically. Then all of a sudden you realize, this is really easy. I don't spend much effort at all. In fact, an earthship, one of the qualities an earthship has is most of them have a linear garden inside this long window. And using gray water, excuse me, they produce all their own food. An average earthship creates all the food that family inside needs to live with.
Inside the home.
Inside the home, inside the living room. And you choose plants that make sense. You know, if you have plants that people don't like to smell, like the Allisons, the onion family, stuff like that, you put them in the garage section. The plants that people love to smell, that smell really wonderful to everybody, like your mints and your salad greens and stuff like that, those are basically in your living room. A lot of people are building homes that have these now, even above ground. They call them sunrooms. And then they have hydroponics and stuff going around with all kinds of pretty plants and everything. And people go out there and think of what a wonderful environment it is. It's because the human animal is not so far removed from our environment, but what we really want to be outside, given a choice. So I choose, in my buildings that I design, to bring the outside inside and make it useful.
One of the things I notice about these earthship designs that I have a little bit of a gripe with is they don't use any of the Eve principle, where you really don't want a lot of sun in the summertime. You want that in the wintertime. So all you need to do is put a little bit of an eave in front of your windows, and you can block a lot of the summer sunshine with an eave. And then
actually,
really
most of them are actually built do have that involved.
Yeah,
Mike Riddle from his building wasn't thinking that. I have a few graphs with the actual architect. You know, he loves technology. So most of his earthships have a big battery around, and they have a room devoted entirely to inverters to convert everything to 60 cycle 120. And there's no reason to do that. Almost everything in modern life can be run on electricity that's direct current, and maybe 48 or 24 volts. If you look inside the guts of all of our electronics, they all run internally on DC power. And you can get things to convert that. So makes it quite simple to do the right things without having to worry about all this power and all these weird things. You know, and you're right, putting eaves over there is easy to do. I saw a bunch of earthships down around Taos 2 years ago, and a lot of them had automatic or manual drapes that would run down and just protect the windows when you wanted to. And if you don't mind running your drapes up and down once in a while, that also protects you from the sun.
Yeah, I noticed, I was reading a book today, Earthship Volume 3, it was published in 96, I think. Imagine they've come up with a lot of things in the last 13 years since that.
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest change I've seen is that people don't try to build what I would call pure forms right now. It used to be if you're a cob artist, you build a cob house, and that was it. If you're in a rock, you build with rock. If you're an earth ship, you build a house that's built around earth tires and stuff like that. Nowadays, it's a lot more common to have someone say, I've got a certain number of tires, and I've got a lot of dirt, and I have a few straw bales, and then I have these intact cultivas in the back, and I have a whole bunch of this, that, and the other, and they'll put them all together. I think of it as a pretty Mad Max scenario, where you just take everything around you and say, wow, I can build with this. So, what's really common today, for example, is to find a ship that's not really an earth ship, because the walls are built out of rock, and technically an earth ship's built with rammed earth tires. And then when you get up high enough, instead of keeping going with the tires, you build cob above that, which is cheaper than hauling tires in, and still pretty darn stable. We've got cob structures that date back 1,500 years in Europe, and they're still as strong as the day they were built. So the biggest change I've seen, I like this, is that we decided to become flexible. Say, what does this system do for us? Why is it this way? And how can I find something where I live to do the same thing? Down at Safe Haven, for example, we're probably not going to build quote-unquote earth ships because there just aren't that many tires that we can get from the smaller metropolitan areas around us. Maybe one or two houses could be built that way. What's that?
Yeah, we've got a lot of rock on the property, so we could use rock.
Right, so we'll use rock to build with mostly. And there's no reason not to. And I don't try to keep water out of my earth ships either. I actually designed to say, we know it's going to rain once in a while. Let's collect that. Let it run down through a French drain and into a cistern and maybe even across the living room through a pool. Why not? Why not make a water feature out of it and have some fun with it? Plant some fish in it and a couple of turtles and, you know, before it gets to our cistern.
How strong are these earth shifts? We're talking about some, maybe some earth changes. People looking at 2012 as maybe some big changes happening on the earth with solar causing maybe some big winds or whatever, 300, 400 mile an hour winds. How big of an issue do you think that is?
Basically not. Classic earth ship is designed to sit in a south-facing hill and mimic the contour of the hill. And they're very massive. These walls are 3 feet across, they're packed dirt, and they're called an earth ship because they're supposed to ride out whatever the earth has to offer. Just like a ship would ride out waves and stuff on the ocean, these are supposed to ride out waves on the shore. And a lot of them have ridden out big earthquakes and tsunamis and a lot of other stuff, so they're one of the more stable structures you can actually build.
Yeah, I guess the name earth ship is that it's earth-friendly, rides with the earth. That's a good way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be going to break here in a second, and when we come back, let's talk about some of the nitty-gritty of a community. We haven't talked about a community center very much. You alluded to it earlier with some of the things you might use in common that everyone doesn't have to have in their own home that you can share in a community center. We'll get into that and some of the documents you might want to have, some things that work, some things that don't in the community that you may want to write into a community document. All when we come back. Stay with us.
Arizona's News Talk Leader. KFNX, AM 1100.
I'm having a great time. Ted, you have something dangling from your chin.
Okay, here, did I get it?
Not yet. It's right under your, I think it is your chin.
Oh, yeah, my double chin. I'm losing it thanks to small step number 85. When eating out, choose smaller portions.
I see, well, it's working. I think your chin just fell into my ceviche.
Take a small step to get healthy at smallstep.gov, a public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
I plugged the ScanGauge 2 into my car in 10 seconds and could read my gas mileage instantly. It helped me save on fuel by improving my driving habits. If my check engine light turns on, I can figure out why without paying a mechanic. This device has saved me money.
The ScanGauge also provides information about engine load, ignition timing, and on my vehicle, it tells me the transmission temperature.
The ScanGauge is manufactured right here in Mesa. Call us at 480-656-3842 or visit us online at ScanGauge.com. Again, that's 480-656-3842.
Have you ever considered turning your unwanted jewelry into cash? Then your answer is Turn It to Cash in Chandler. See us turn your old or new, broken or scrap, matched or mismatched gold and silver jewelry into cash. You can see us do the whole process in front of your eyes. Visit us at 1200 North Arizona Avenue, just 1/4 mile north of Ray Road. What can we turn into cash? Gold, diamonds, silver jewelry, broken chains and bracelets, mismatched earrings, rings with missing stones, gold and silver coins, turquoise and silver jewelry, sterling flat, dental gold, scrap jewelry, and wedding bands. So don't wait any longer. Come and visit Turn It to Cash Monday through Friday, 9:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., Saturdays till 4. We are located at 1200 North Arizona Avenue, Chandler, just 1/4 mile north of Ray Road. Or check us out online at www.turnittocash.com. Mention KFNX News Talk Radio 1100 and receive an additional $5 for every $100. That's more cash in your wallet. Turn it to cash or licensed buyers or secondhand gold, silver, and platinum. TurnItToCash.com.
Free energy now.
Drilling Allen coming back at you. I should mention that Free Energy Now has been brought to you by eHarmony.com, where singles are matched based on compatibility. On average, 236 eHarmony members marry every day in the U.S. as a result of being matched on eHarmony. Someone you know very well, someone I know very well, who was married last week, met his partner through eHarmony.com. I'll be attending a reception for them this coming Saturday. Log on to eHarmony.com, and you can review all of your matches absolutely free. If you want to subscribe, use the promotion code EHPESN. That's for eHarmony PESN. That's our call letters. And you'll get one of 3 months free. And again, that promotion code is EHPESN. Today we are talking to James Torgerson. We call him Torg, from Safe Haven Villages. That's safehavenvillages.com. A project I'm involved with, we'll be talking about sustainability, intentional communities in general, and Torg. We said that in this last segment we're going to be talking about some of the documents and some of the minutiae involved in intentional communities. Maybe we can address that for a few minutes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You want me to take the reins at this point, huh?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, an intentional community, to put it quite simply, is a community with an intent behind it. And that means that some group of people, or even one person, might get together and say, you know what, I would like to live in a community that does this, where the people are this. And if you look very carefully at it, you realize that most of history, the civilization of man, has been set up around intentional communities. The pilgrims, when they came over to Plymouth Rock, had a certain intent. They wanted their religion. They didn't care if they weren't here for religious freedom. They were just here to practice the way they wanted. different communities would set up all over the world and say, here's the intent of this community. And that's what we're doing here. We just said we want a community that has certain things and doesn't have certain things. And saying, hey, if your ethic fits ours, come on down. I've had people complain about that. So how can you tell people they can't do this or can't do that? Well, we're not going to. We're not going to tell someone what they can and can't do. What we're saying is this community is set up this way. If you want to come play in our sandbox, then you have to understand what our stand's made out of.
Yeah, and what are some of the things that typically are maybe boondoggles that communities should stay away from in their founding documents?
Well, there have been different phases of intentional communities. The modern era is actually kind of thick with them. The hippies, for example, they set up a lot of intentional communities not understanding much about the earth. All they knew is that they didn't like what mom and dad's post-depression world looked like. It was too materialistic and stuff, and they had this weird idea that a bunch of them went out and just hung out with who they wanted to, had sex with who they wanted to, did the drugs they wanted to, and threw some seeds around so they could handle it. Doesn't work that way. You do need organization. You do need some caveats. You do need some bylaws. You need someone to work. So a lot of communities fell apart and continue to fall apart today because there's no provision that says this is what you need to do as a member of our community. You need to put so many hours a week in doing this, 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 and this. Because there's work that has to be done. You have to harvest plants. You have to plant plants. You have to clean the roads. You have to. You just have to. The other thing that gets things in a lot of communities is to have too loose of a relationship bylaws. Jealousies have killed a lot of communities. But I didn't think there were any. You know, a lot of the hippies, and I'm a hippie. I'll be the first one to admit it and create it, asked the wrong questions, came up with the wrong answers. And they tried free-willing communities, and it just flat didn't work. We're also in our community going to do nothing that's overtly illegal. We don't need the police coming in and saying, you know what, you guys are doing this, and our laws say you can't do that, so therefore you can't be it anymore. So we're telling people that right up front.
Okay. Another thing we want to talk about is community center.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about?
Well, a community is a place where people commune with each other. That's where the community comes from. There's some kind of essential something going on. The ones that set themselves up is too isolated, which a lot of condominium sets or gated communities are about. They forget the fact that these are people, and people like to interact. So in our case, one of the first things we're going to build will be a community center. Places where people can do things that involve them as members of a cooperative community. There will be simple things like the tote board up there shows what chores need to be done. But they'll also have a piano, will have a stage, will have a place where you can, you know, teach children, a place where you can teach adults. We'll have classrooms, we'll have dormitories. We'll have a community kitchen there. A lot of people don't like to cook their own food. And we'll have people whose job will be or whose passion and profession would be to cook food for the community. That's what they want to do. That's what they like to do. So we try to find places for everybody and make as many things circle around this heartthrob or this nerve center, the community, as possible. We don't want to have a quote-unquote community of isolated hermits hanging out there and just not interacting with anybody. That's not where we're coming from. We think strength is in cooperating numbers and synergy.
And I want to mention, in terms of, you know, putting a plug in into our particular community that you and I are working on together here, you know, I put up my house for sale, and we're going to take half of the proceeds to buy the land. We're actually probably going to have to cut it in half, get the first 40 acres, and then the remaining 40 acres after a year, for example. But we're going to, because we're, this sustainable community is such that, you know, you really don't have to have a lot of resources to build one of these earth ships. We're only going to require about half of that upfront money to get the to buy the home or to get the materials, and then the labor will go into build the home. And, you know, the rest of the other half of the home will go in toward getting the land. So, you know, that gives you an idea of the sustainable principles that, you know, you don't have to have a lot of money to do this. It's actually very simple. Maybe you can speak to that for a minute.
Well, I actually mentioned it earlier in passing. If you step back and say, what are we really thinking of, what we really want to do? Most people, and they're kind of given this ethic all through school, high school, and everything else, is that your job when you go to college is to make money. But your job when you go to college is not to make money. Your job when you go to college is to sustain yourself as a human being on this planet and your family, and to be able to know how to do that with. Now, if you realize that your position, for example, if what you really need out of this is a home, you don't need money because you're going to use the money to buy a home. So if what you look at and say, you know, our job here is to get the land, and that might require straight money. There may be no way around that, but there might be. You know, it depends on what the owner really needs. But once we've got to that point, then the next job is to say, Sterling and his wife and his kids need to have a home. So let's take a look at the options. Where do we do it? What do we do with it? How do we build it? Stuff like that. Because that's the bottom line. We want to build you guys a house. We don't want to make money and hire a contractor to come in with all his equipment stuff and build a house where most of the money goes to him and his laborers. We'll keep it in the community. So the structures we choose to build are labor-intensive, but that's fine because we have labor. Because that's the bottom line. And life is always like that. I had some students here over the weekend studying urban shamanism. The bottom line is that they wanted education. The bottom line is not they wanted money to buy an education with. They wanted the education. So they took the time to come here, sit down with us, spend the weekend to get some labor done that we needed. The trade's complete. They go home happy. We stay home happy. And everybody's got done, and no money changes hands. That's the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah, you know, that's sustainable. It means that basically you can keep this thing going. It's not, you're not going to run out of gas at the end of the day, so to speak.
Right.
Renewable, sustainable. Again, the website where people can learn more from TORG, safehavenvillages.com. That's our community project. I hope you've enjoyed this segment with TORG, James D. Torgerson. TORG is a short name for him. His contact information is on that website, which is actually housed over at pezwiki.com, our website right now. We'll probably eventually move it to a domain of its own, but for now it's housed at Pezwiki. So safehavenvillages.org and com forwards to our website. But, Tori, I appreciate you joining us. Any final words before we end up this segment?
Yeah, I just got a message from my daughter, Bethany, who's an attorney in Phoenix, and she says, tell them about Don and Z's gardens called Green Zona. I guess they do sustainable xeriscaping and stuff down there, so there's a plug for all you guys in Phoenix.
Okay. Yeah, well, I appreciate you coming on. You know, it's been a lot of fun. It's been a fun project. I've enjoyed meeting with you on a weekly basis as we get together talking about how we're going to pull all this stuff together. a lot of work, but it'll be a lot of fun too.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Your Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.